Hey, welcome back to Politico Tech. Today's Tuesday, March 12th. I'm Stephen Overly. Disinformation in politics is nothing new, but the rise of social media and now the arrival of artificial intelligence has made the problem far more pervasive. Journalist Sasha Eisenberg tells me political campaigns have had to run a new playbook as a result, one that's fit for this era of never-ending fake news, foreign interference, and online deception. In his book, The Lie Detectives, Sasha documents the lessons learned back in 2020 as political consultants grappled with online disinformation. He tells me how they apply in 2024 in the face of a changing tech and social media landscape. Here's our conversation. In The Lie Detectives, you set out to uncover the political playbook for essentially overcoming disinformation to win elections. Does that playbook actually exist?
I think there are a lot of new instincts, tools, techniques that people in campaigns have had for deciding how and when somebody lying about you on the internet is worth responding to, and how you can do it without drawing attention to a false attack or amplifying it through algorithms.
And is that the risk, that responding to these attacks ultimately amplifies them? How does a campaign go about navigating that?
Yeah, so I think there are a few risks. There are findings from cognitive science that show that if you try to correct a misimpression, often you can end up affirming it in the mind of the person who hears it, right? The other problem is that the way that algorithms are structured to reward engagement. And so what a lot of people started doing, which is like, you know, quote tweeting or replying to a post by fact check, actually can have the consequence of helping to drive traffic to the underlying post. The bigger cost, I think, for people within political campaigns in particular, is that on any given day running for office, you have a bunch of strategic and tactical imperatives you want to fulfill. And if you get distracted as a campaign by everything online that is inaccurate about you, you will lose your ability to communicate on your terms. And so the big challenge that the political communicators I write about in the book face is how to distinguishing the signal from the noise. You know, the internet is rife with falsehoods. Only a small share of them are actually going to probably be electorally harmful to you.
And what evidence, if any, do you see that campaigns in this 2024 cycle are using this playbook, are kind of making those distinctions you're talking about between the disinformation that merits a response and does not?
Yeah, I write a lot about the 2020 Biden campaign in my book, and the people who were involved in this work then or in even more senior roles in the campaign now, they had a lot of time and money that is not available to your average political campaign. But one of the important things that they did in the summer of 2020 was to try to make a distinction between what they saw as the traditional approach to countering disinformation, which they described as a supply side approach, that there would be a piece of content, I don't know, a deepfake video or a post that makes a false claim, and that people would think about the disinformation as a supply side problem. We need to counter this particular piece of content. They thought that it was more important to think of this as a demand side problem. The disinformation narratives that would be most damaging to Biden's campaign, they determined, were the ones that voters responded to. And so they set out on a big research project to identify which of those bits of disinformation would be, as they like to say, market moving, actually move voters away from Biden, as opposed to just circulate among Trump supporters or be heard by a lot of people, and maybe even believed, but not in areas that would change their vote choice. You know, one of the important findings that they had here was that a lot of people had heard about things related to Hunter Biden and allegations of corruption on the part of Joe Biden. But the persuadable voters whom they cared about actually said that this would not affect their likelihood of voting for Biden. And focus groups revealed it's because they didn't believe Biden was motivated by personal financial gain. But what Trump called the Sleepy Joe story, that Biden was old, maybe mentally diminished, that actually was threatening. And in the focus groups, they uncovered why this was. It wasn't that voters were worried about Biden's physical fitness. It was that they saw him as a fundamentally weak figure in political terms. And that, as one of the pollsters who did this project told me, that they were worried that he would not be the author of his presidency. And so there had been this, you know, that the communications department on the campaign had been pushing, we need to have more photo ops of Joe Biden riding a bike. Why don't we have him run up the stairs of the airplane? And the digital team that was involved on this counter disinformation project came back and said, no, voters don't need to see him like stretching his legs. They want to basically know that he's going to run his government and know what he stands for. And so what they found was the most effective way to push back at this were these, it sounds so banal, but these like 15-second digital ads that show Biden speaking to camera, unedited, on things like, here's what I think economic policy should look like. And they felt that that actually sort of like assuaged voters' concerns that he would be controlled by, you know, would be a puppet of other people because he wasn't strong enough to assert himself. And so I think that that's a place where you see campaigns thinking about this in a not just a sort of whack-a-mole approach to what is the trending bit of disinfo today, which is I think often how the media covers these things, and think about it more holistically as like, what are our strategic objectives? How do we push back on the identify things are damaging and push back and do it in a way that's not amplifying the underlying claim?
You know, it was interesting for one of the big takeaways for these campaigns to be that the sort of social media platform and the source of the disinformation mattered less than really this idea of whether or not voters would be primed to kind of believe it to begin with. Because as a tech reporter, so much of the conversation that I've written about, that I've covered, is, you know, questions about how Facebook and Instagram handle disinformation from Russian or Chinese outlets, or how TikTok can be used to sow this domestic political discord. I mean, does that mean that efforts to sort of tamp down on online information on these specific platforms has been kind of misguided?
No, I mean, I think that there's sort of two very different challenges. I think if you're a social media platform that is developing and enforcing policies on content, it doesn't so much matter what the potential impact of that disinformation is. I think you're aiming for clarity and consistency in your policy so they can be universally applied quickly and efficiently without a lot of ambiguity, right? And if you're a government institution thinking about a regulatory framework for accountability around disinformation, you're probably less interested in tracking the impact, but having the kind of legal clarity about what where the bounds are. If you're a campaign, you don't really even care about what's true or false or how true or how false it is. You are concerned with, is this harming my chances of getting elected? And so proportionality is, I think, a far bigger consideration for political actors who are working in the election context, because Facebook or any other social media, TikTok, should have a policy that applies to a post that's seen by six people as much as a policy that is seen by a post that's seen by a million people. Right. It would be impossible to enforce a code in any real way otherwise. But for a campaign, the post seen by six people is probably not a problem. And if it's seen by a million people, are they a million people who live in the state in which you are running? Or are they a million people in a different country? Are they a million people who are already strong supporters of your opponent and are never going to vote for you one way or the other and are basically making up lies about you because it's how they basically express their dislike for you? Or are these getting in front of a million people whose votes are in play on issues that they care about? And so that is both a conceptual distinction, but also requires like a lot of tools and data to intelligently distinguish who's seeing something, and so you can begin to think about what the electoral impact of it might be.
We'll be right back. Talking with all of these political consultants and the folks who are sort of hyper-focused on campaigns and election outcomes, I'm curious if you found any tension or frustration among them with kind of how these tech platforms have operated. Because I imagine if they're trying to counteract disinformation, these platforms are not only a channel for that disinformation to spread, they're also important channels for these counter narratives to get distributed. So I wonder if that was a source of tension that you found in any way.
Yeah, this was not the most difficult reporting task I've ever taken on. Like, the folks who do this are dripping with disdain for the platforms. And I think they're a lot less bashful than they might have been 5 or 6 years ago about articulating that. You know, I think that there was a period in 2018-19 when all the platforms led by Facebook wanted to make a big show of taking content moderation seriously, especially around election disinformation. They have all in various ways backed off from that. I think some for sort of business economic reasons, some because the threat of immediate regulation from Congress has diminished from where they thought it was a few years ago. I think some of it is because post Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter, Twitter had been to some degree a sort of putting upward pressure on content moderation policies, and now is sort of setting a floor And I think a lot of them see little reward to doing more in this environment. And so I think that the folks who started doing this work in American politics in 2017, 2018, 2019 that I write about, they didn't think necessarily then that the platforms were, you know, well-intentioned in a kind of necessarily in a civic way to do the right things. But they saw the ways that the companies thought that their business interests, selling political advertising, at least in part, would be aligned with playing nice with political figures. And they thought that their jobs in part was to help the companies enforce their own policies by reporting stuff and submitting takedown requests. I think that they have come to believe that the companies are not interested in enforcing their policies, especially if it means that they will get crosswise with political actors. And at this moment, it means Republicans, you know, in Congress. I think that stuff like the Jim Jordan Weaponization Committee in the House, the stuff that state attorneys general are doing with lawsuits against tech companies for so-called censorship through content moderation, it scares the companies from wanting to do much of anything. And I think that the folks who I write about, mostly Democrats or those on the left, don't see the companies as sort of honest brokers in any of this work.
If we think since 2020 and that presidential election cycle, I mean, technology has changed quite a bit. A lot of these social media platforms, as you're saying, they have changed their policies or in some cases rolled back some of their responses to misinformation. AI has become a greater concern on the campaign trail since then. I mean, how applicable are your findings about this sort of playbook for responding to disinformation in today's election cycle?
I think people should read my book this year. I think if you leave it around for a few years, the world will have changed a little bit. So I tried to sort of deliver a snapshot of what I thought was the kind of cutting edge of thinking about how to deal with these questions. I think we should see the environment's going to change, not just because of technology changing, but I think that the platform's attitudes towards this are likely to be cyclical, right? I mean, if you think back just over the last 15 years, I think we went through a wave of sort of tech optimism that Barack Obama's election in 2008, Arab Spring. I think tech companies wanted to be associated with political change, saw themselves both, you know, a core part of their public identity and their business interests were tied to, hey, we're a place that civic movements can take hold and people can become engaged politically. I think the sort of Cambridge Analytica backlash and the fake news scandal of 2016 and 17 started to make them aware of the downsides of being associated as a place for political speech. But that sort of period that I mentioned earlier of 2018-19, they made a show, you know, Facebook was like opening an election war room, not just for the US, but ahead of the Brazilian elections that year. And they wanted to make a display that they were taking seriously their responsibility here. And things have changed in the last few years. They could change back. I could easily see in early 2025 or 2027, we have a composition in Congress where something like Section 230 repeal seems like a possibility. And the social media platforms decide that they want to go back to trying to convince lawmakers that they are taking this problem on themselves and do not need to be subject to civil liability for stuff they publish, and that leads to a bunch of decisions about content moderation policies, application execution that look different than they do now. I could also imagine a moment where, you know, we have a candidacy like Obama's that is kind of returns, you know, that's associated with social media platforms and online organizing and such. And companies see a business interest and a reputational interest in being associated with it in cultural terms. Now you have Meta saying, you know, we don't want our apps to be a place for politics. And I could see it them thinking in a few years, no, politics is good for business. And so I don't buy into sort of an inevitable declension narrative of either technological change. And I definitely think that the social media platforms are making choices every day, and those choices will change as their business and political imperatives shift.
Excellent. Well, Sasha, the book is called The Lie Detectives. Thank you for joining us on Politico Tech.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Stephen.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. Before we sign off, I want to make sure you know about the Politico Live event on Wednesday, March 13th. It's our annual healthcare summit, and we'll be bringing together policymakers to talk about everything from abortion and election politics to drug prices to the Ozempic craze. And I'll be there for a live conversation about healthcare and AI with Verily's Chief Scientific and Medical Officer, Andrew Trister. So be sure to join us. You can find out more information at politico.com. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here tomorrow.